of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, January 30th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Nigeria explodes in violence. We'll find out why. Twitter.com announces country-specific censorship, and author and historian Nancy L. Cohen on her new book Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, plus a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. William Gregory Ock, a U.S. citizen working in Nigeria, was released on Friday after a week in captivity. He was held hostage by gunmen demanding a ransom of $333,000 in the country's volatile and oil-rich Niger Delta. The January 20th kidnapping came on the same day as a wave of coordinated bombings and shootings racking the northern city of Kano and killing over 180 people. The Islamist group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the attack, which was meant as retribution for the alleged torture of its members by the government. Boko Haram has been active since 2003 in northern Nigeria, an impoverished, predominantly Muslim region that is far less developed than the south. The growing instability of Nigeria's north prompted Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan to announce the possibility of a dialogue between his government and Boko Haram. Friday's announcement follows the partial restoration last week of a government oil subsidy that was cut on January 1st, which caused oil prices to skyrocket, going from $1.70 a gallon to $3.50 a gallon. The spike triggered a rise in the price of food and other necessities, paralyzing Nigerian consumers, many of whom make less than $2 a day. The partial subsidy brought the price of fuel down to $2.27 a gallon and came after 8 days of strikes, widespread popular discontent, and trade union plans to halt oil production. Meanwhile, concerns over the environmental impact of two recent oil spills in Nigeria continue. In December, 40,000 barrels of oil spilled in the Bonga oil field off the Nigerian coast at a facility operated by the Royal Dutch Shell Company, making it Nigeria's worst spill since 1998. Also, just this month on January 16th, a fire broke out on a Chevron oil rig in the Funiwa field that, according to a Chevron official, will likely burn for another 30 days. Joining me on the phone this morning is Aniedi Okure, is the executive director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. Welcome to Uprising, Aniedi.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, there's a lot to discuss regarding what's happening in Nigeria. First, let's talk about Boko Haram, this organization that has claimed responsibility for attacks, killing well over 100 people, and who are claiming that they are being repressed by the government. What primarily is the motivation of this organization?
Yes, their motivation is a desire to spread the Sharia, the Islamic law, across the northern states, akin to Al-Qaeda kind of, you know, rule. And so they have started, they've been here for about 10 years now, almost. And their primary aim is to spread Islamic rule in the northern states. And in so doing, they have used force to achieve that end. And it has been found that they are supported by outsiders, not just outsiders in the Middle East, but in the neighboring countries, because every now and then they found out that the young men that come to fight, some of them are Nigerians, but some of them are coming up from the neighboring countries, especially Niger and Chad.
And what exactly is the government's response to this? And is the government responding in a way that is protecting the interests of ordinary Nigerians, or are its actions making things worse?
There is, first of all, the government, not this present government. I mean, it has been there, I said, 10 years plus. So over the years, the government paid little attention to this issue. It should have tackled it right when it started. But then it became a haphazard response that they'll go and attack them or arrest some few people and then just let back without following up to investigate and find out who are these people, who are they connected to, what they want, who are they recruiting, who is supporting them. And the sophistication of the bomb explosions and attacks, the way it's coordinated, shows that it is not just a disgruntled group of people, but it is well coordinated, as you have seen in recent attacks at the police station and the immigration office and security office in Kano, or the coordinated attack on the UN building in Abuja, or the bombing of St. Teresa's Church on Christmas Day. So this is not just a group of dismantled people. However, there is the issue, another issue to look at, namely that this group has been able to thrive in an environment of lawlessness and lack of accountability. And that is something that needs to be looked at closely. Because if there was real rule of law and accountability, this group could have been contained and nipped in the bud 10 years ago.
Let's talk about the row over the oil subsidy that some reports say prompted Nigeria's biggest ever protest. What, first of all, prompted the oil subsidy to the repealing of the oil subsidy in the first place? And can you tell us a little bit more about how Nigerians reacted?
Yes, that's something I like to talk about. The oil subsidy, even though it's been challenged, let me give a preamble here. Petrol, as they call it in Nigeria, you know, the use of gas is more than transportation. Petrol is the life wire of the people. The infrastructure in Nigeria has been decaying over the past 10, 15 years, such that the roads are bad, telephone landlines have completely been out. People now use cell phones around. Electricity is very haphazard. Some sections of the country might be for a week without electricity at all. So people have to buy generators. And to keep the generators running, they need gas to put into it. They need gas to put their generator, to charge telephones, to be able to watch television, to turn on their computers, to connect to the internet, to keep items cool in the grocery and supermarkets. So light or gas in that case becomes the life wire of the people. Let's imagine this, that in the U.S., say in L.A., you have power outage for 1 week. Imagine what life could be.
Right.
That's what Nigerians suffer for weeks, for months, and for years. So with that as a background, let's go back to the so-called oil removal of oil subsidy.
So when the government announced the end of this oil subsidy on January 1st, people were predictably outraged because that impacts literally their way, you know, their ability to just to do day-to-day things. What did the strikes look like across the country?
Yes, it was massive. In fact, as they described in Nigeria, it was the mother of all strikes, in the sense that there was a quick and immediate response from across the country, east, west, north, south, everywhere, because it literally paralyzed the people. They couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't function as I said, Nigeria can't function as is now because of the lack of electricity. So there is a real dependence on gas, a real dependence on oil, not just for transportation, but for life of the people. So imagine a situation where oil was like $1.70 a gallon, and overnight it became $3.70, 165% increase.
Right.
That was just unbearable. And the government claimed that it needed this revenue to invest in infrastructure. Nigerians wouldn't trust them, and they have every reason to. Why is that? Because over the years, the oil revenue has been siphoned by politicians and appropriated to themselves and bank abroad. And in collaboration with their collaborators, they have appropriated the revenues of oil to themselves, to their families, and to their friends. A case in point is that you find in December last year, the Congress identified many companies, as they refer to it, the oil cartel, who are stealing oil from Nigeria, who are misappropriating funds to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars.
And when you say the oil cartel, you're referring to multinational corporations?
Yeah, multinational corporations, you know, who are doing business in Nigeria. Of course, they are doing that in collaboration with some Nigerians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for example, a case in point, Halliburton, for example, about a year ago, was fined by the U.S. Congress here to the tune of the U.S. Department of Justice to the tune of $382 million for violations of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And equally, the Security and Exchange Commission here in the U.S. fined Halliburton $177 million to settle bribery charges against former President Dick Cheney. So you have these people outside and Nigerians who are collaborating with them to deprive the citizens of their oil wealth. And so when the citizens said, oh, we will use this revenue to invest in infrastructure, they didn't believe him. And they have every right not to believe, because the same people keep recycling the money and appropriating the money to themselves.
So let's talk about how the government has responded to the taking away of the oil subsidy. But let me remind my listeners that I'm speaking with Aniedi Okure, Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network. It's an organization of advocates for responsible American relations with Africa. We're talking about Nigeria, where there has not only been very high levels of violence recently, but also high levels of protests. And there are also a couple of major oil spills that happened in the last 2 months that I want to talk about. And at the same time that the protests were happening against the oil subsidy removal, the Islamist group Boko Haram that we were discussing earlier launched the worst of their attacks. The government has backed down, I understand, but it hasn't actually put back into place the original subsidy. So oil is a little bit cheaper, but not as cheap as it was before. Is that true? And if so, has that helped to quell some of the protest?
Yeah, it has quelled some of the protests, but it's not over, because what happened with the so-called removal of subsidy is that it awakened Nigerians to the corruption that has gone on in that country for so long. Yes, it's true that it reduced the oil subsidy from the proposed 141 naira a liter. Now a liter, a gallon is 4 liters. So, you know, it reduced it to 97 naira a liter. That is still high. That is still very high for the people. And one thing is that once the price goes up in terms of the consequences of the price hike in petrol, because it affected food, transportation, other items, grocery items. Once that price goes up, the sources informed us that the prices have not really come down. And so life is still very hard for the people.
So what about these environmental disasters that have happened in Nigeria? You refer to the oil cartel, these major corporations, Royal Dutch Shell, Chevron and others that are taking advantage of these of Nigeria's oil. I mean, of course, part of the reason why Nigeria is a useful country for these companies to participate in is that they can get away with these sorts of oil spills. Is that accurate?
You know, absolutely. You touch the point. They can get away with it. A case in point, you know, it is in the books that flaring of gas is illegal in Nigeria. You know, that's in the books. But what happens, these oil companies continue to flare gas. You know, you go to the Delta, Niger Delta region in the night. The skyline is lit, not with electricity, but with gas being flared by these oil companies. And they decide to do that because their corrupt officials will only give them a slap on the wrist with a little fine. So they prefer to flare the gas and pay the fine that is pittance in compared to what they would have done to contain the gas. Nigeria's oil is one of the best, if not the best, in the world, in the sense that it takes very little effort to refine it.
I see. You know?
And so these companies are refining the oil and making huge profits. At the same time, the ecological disaster is unconscionable. The livelihood of the people in the Niger Delta region, from the pollution of the rivers to the land, has been turned upside down. And each time there is oil spill, each time there is this flaring of gas, each time there is all the oil leakage, they'll make noise for a few days, a few weeks, and I don't know, they bribe some officials and it's gone. And so time and time again, the people are left with the short end of the stick. They are left with a polluted environment. They've seen their livelihood disappear will be in front of them. The people who were fishing in those waterways cannot fish anymore. Farmers can't plant anymore because the damage is enormous. As you say, as we speak, the oil spill in the last 2 months has been the greatest since 1998. And in the meantime, we are talking about removal of oil subsidy, and the oil spill is not really getting attention because it's been happening time and time again. Many of them don't make their way to the press for anybody to hear. So the destruction of these oil companies, the destruction they have caused to the people, is unconscionable.
Well, I want to thank you, Anyeri Okure, very much for joining us today. We'd love to have you back on the show to discuss how ordinary Nigerians are continuing to resist some of what is happening in Nigeria after major protests that were among the largest ever seen in the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You too. Anyeri Okure is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network. It's a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at Twitter.com's recent announcement of country-specific censorship and how Twitter users are responding. After that, a short commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then Nancy Cohen joins us in studio to discuss her new book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. Stay tuned.
George Clooney said it best in the film Ocean's 11. You're either in or you're out. Hi, I'm Chris Coleman.
I'm Rita Gonzalez.
I'm Ralph Radabaugh.
I'm Terry Garay. And for the record, we're out. In fact, on Monday, January 9th, we're going to be debuting our show, The Out Agenda, right here on KPFK.
Our focus is LGBT issues. Now tune in, because the voices we want to hear are yours.
The Out Agenda, Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM.
House by The Remainers. Find out more about them online at myspace.com/TheRemainersMusic or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A proposed mass boycott of the website Twitter.com by users on Saturday did not gain steam despite 48 hours of outrage expressed throughout the social media site over a policy change announced on Thursday. Through a blog post on Twitter.com, the company informed users that individual tweets may be blocked if content violates the laws of the user's country. This is not a complete reversal of policy for the microblogging site, but Twitter came under fire from users who accuse it of kowtowing to oppressive regimes in order to expand its global presence for profit. Twitter explained how blocking tweets will work, saying, quote, "Until now, the only way we could take account of a country's limits was to remove content globally. Starting today, we give ourselves the ability to reactively withhold content from users in a specific country while keeping it available in the rest of the world. If and when we are required to withhold a tweet, we will attempt to let the user know and we will clearly mark when the content has been withheld." The company used laws in Germany and France that prohibit pro-Nazi activities as an example of country-specific laws that may lead to blocked tweets. The company alluded to, but did not name, nations with much broader laws against speech and stated, quote, "As we continue to grow internationally, we will enter countries with different ideas about the contours of freedom of expression. Some will differ so much that we will not be able to exist there." The site has pledged to report blocked tweets to chillingeffect.org, a project of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and a handful of law schools that track, among other things, legal orders to remove content online. However, the microblogging site reserves the right to abide by any gag orders imposed by a country that bars disclosure of the details of censored tweets. Joining me on the phone this morning is Eva Galperin, international activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome to Uprising, Eva.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let me see if I understand this correctly. As far as I can tell, the Twitter.com website is now saying that countries that have that requested to take down certain tweets, for example, last year during the Egyptian revolution, Hosni Mubarak could have contacted them if these laws were in place then and said to Twitter, remove these tweets that are helping the Egyptian revolution gain steam, and Twitter would have complied. Is that true?
That's absolutely not true. What Twitter has said that they will do, and what they have been doing for years already, is that they will comply with applicable court orders in countries where they have a presence and are therefore bound by law. Right now, Twitter has offices in the United States, in the UK, in Ireland, and I think they're looking to open up an office in Germany, and I think they may have some in France. And so they're bound by those laws. But because Twitter does not have an office in Egypt, they would not be required to comply with those court orders.
I see. So they are looking to expand globally, literally with offices around the world. And when they do that, for example, if they did open an office in Egypt, then they would be bound by those laws.
Yes, they would.
So what is problematic about what they're proposing in terms of internet freedom?
Well, to begin with, what they're doing is less problematic than you might think, because the overall effect is less censorship rather than more censorship. Prior to this, when Twitter received a court order, which they've been, you know, complying with, again, for years, all that they could do is take down that tweet for everyone. Now what they're doing is they will take down that tweet in the country where they received the court order, and they leave a message saying, if you can't see this tweet because it's been blocked in your country, which gives people the opportunity to use proxies such as Tor in order to get around the state censorship and see what's going on. So what Twitter is actually doing is they're allowing users to see the censorship when it's going on, which is more than can be said for companies such as Facebook. When Facebook takes down a post, nobody knows about it, there's no accountability, and there's certainly no way of getting around it.
Hmm. And the fact that Twitter is pledging to report blocked tweets, is that also something that's encouraging? However, I mentioned also, if a country that it has an office says that it cannot disclose that it has blocked tweets, won't it have to comply?
Yes, it will. Again, Twitter is bound by the laws of the countries in which it has offices, and that's one of the reasons why Twitter needs to be extremely circumspect about where it expands to.
What are Twitter's plans, and do you foresee that it might want to expand to countries like China, for example, where internet censorship is a tool of the state?
Well, I think it's possible that Twitter could choose to expand to China, but it doesn't seem particularly likely. If you recall, a couple of years ago, Google expanded into China, and they never even had servers there. They simply made the service available. There was Google.cn, and they were asked to censor their search results. And they complied for a while, but shortly afterwards there was a hacking incident in which Chinese government hackers attempted to get into Gmail, and Google chose to pull out. And I think it's very likely that Twitter has learned Google's lesson and doesn't seem terribly inclined to move into places like China.
I'm speaking with Eva Galperin. She's an international activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we're talking about new policy changes by the website Twitter.com, one of the top used social networking sites in the world. Now, let's talk about what exactly this means for the United States. We're in a country where supposedly freedom of expression is among the best in the world, and yet we're also living in a country that the national security state is expanding. When we had the WikiLeaks explosion, there were websites that were asked to, for example, like PayPal, to not fund groups like WikiLeaks or to take down their ability for WikiLeaks to get funding. Are you seeing Twitter having to comply with dictates from the Pentagon and from Homeland Security? Eva Galperin, are you with us?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you see that this might be a problem in the United States?
Well, actually, that's not exactly the case. Again, Google has to comply with legal court orders, which it has done. In the case of WikiLeaks and Visa and PayPal and MasterCard, all of them gave in to informal backroom pressure to withdraw their services, which is something that Twitter has explicitly said that they would not do. In relation to the WikiLeaks investigation, Twitter actually received a sealed D order for the for information about several of their Twitter users as part of the WikiLeaks investigation, and sought to unseal that order in order to give their users the opportunity to hire attorneys. And full disclosure, EFF is involved in one of those cases. We represent Brigitte Jones' daughter.
Well, Eva, finally, the user protest that started on Saturday didn't gain much steam. What prompted that? And do you think that that's a result of not a very clear understanding of what Twitter is doing?
I think that the protests were largely the result of a misunderstanding about exactly what Twitter was doing. People are very concerned about internet censorship right now. In the wake of SOPA and PIPA, people are concerned about ACTA, and it was a very easy mistake to make. Twitter was not entirely clear about exactly what it was that they were doing, and they had some really unfortunate and vague wording that left a lot of people with the impression that they were going to start censoring tweets at the request of authoritarian regimes. And that would simply be unacceptable.
Hmm. Well, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I'm assuming, is paying close attention to the details of these policy changes. Is that the best website for people to pay attention to or to visit to stay informed about changes to policies and threats to internet freedom?
Yes, absolutely.
And the website is?
The website is www.efs.org.
That's EFF.org. That's a website of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I want to thank you, Eva Galperin, very much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Eva Galperin is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Again, the website is EFF.org. This is Uprising. And after this commentary by political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, we will speak with Nancy L. Cohen. She's going to join us in studio to discuss her new book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. Stay tuned.
Of idiots and sages. How much is your child worth? How much is your grandchild worth? These are not trick questions. They arise from the news that North Carolina recently announced cash compensation to thousands of survivors of their state sterilization program that ran from 1929 to 1974, an astonishing 45 years. North Carolina was but one of many southern states that sterilized people whom it considered as defective. In this, they were supported by authorities as august as the U.S. Supreme Court, which in its now infamous Buck v. Bell case found a state had a right to sterilize its citizens, and a citizen had no constitutional right to oppose it. For in the words of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, three generations of imbeciles are enough. A North Carolina task force recommended payment of $50,000 each to each survivor. This horrific state practice and the Supreme Court's chilling reasoning in support thereof gives us some insight into how social prejudices and attitudes percolate into all sections of society, and despite their self-evident madness, take on an air of the repellent in the passage of time. If a state could sterilize its own so-called citizens, deny people the right to have children, what is such a state but a dictatorship of arrogance and power? From Prison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
KPFK.
Powered by the people.
Educating the people on the illnesses in society.
Join us on Sojourner Truth Tuesday to Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. Tuesday. The presiding judge of L.A. County Children's Court issues an order to finally open the court to the public and the media. We get reaction. 70% of chocolate's cocoa comes from West Africa, and 1.8 million children are at risk of exploitation on cocoa farms. We hear from activists working for slave-free chocolate. Joanne Griffith joins us to discuss the newly released book she edited, Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, also our weekly Earth Minute. Sojourner Truth Tuesday, January 31st, 7 to 8 a.m. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum was asked at a campaign event in New Hampshire earlier this month if he would abort a gay baby. The evangelical Christian candidate avoided the question but has been dogged at campaign events on his controversial views on gender, reproductive rights, and gay rights. He is not alone in his views. On Sunday, another GOP candidate, Newt Gingrich, called for an investigation of in vitro fertilization clinics, where couples struggling with infertility attempt to conceive. Gingrich has accused frontrunner Mitt Romney of being pro-abortion. However, Romney has maintained his solid anti-abortion credentials. In a new book entitled Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, historian, author, and Huffington Post writer Nancy L. Cohen investigates what she calls a shadow movement deep within both parties that is responsible for America's current political crisis. The fact that issues of contraception, abortion, gay rights, and more are deemed such important litmus tests politically at a time when economic injustice threatens to tear apart the fabric of American society is a testament to the strength of the sexual counter-revolution. The backlash to the feminist and gay rights revolutions from the extreme right that have increasingly dominated the nation's politics. In Delirium, Nancy Cohen asks the question of why, when the U.S. is mired in its worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, would birth control, abortion, and the rights of gays and women top the agenda of the Republican Party? But Cohen also maintains that the sexual counter-revolution has been a bipartisan affair, indicting the Democratic Party of political calculation at the expense of women's and gay rights. Even President Obama has waffled, saying that his views were, quote, evolving. Nancy Cohen is a historian, author, and contributor to the Huffington Post. She is the author of two earlier books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism, 1865 to 1914. Her writing has appeared in the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Business History Review, and elsewhere. And she now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Nancy Cohen.
Hello, Sonali. Wonderful to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, is it unusual that at a time when we're seeing a very important election, the GOP candidates, of course, the field is narrowing each week, it seems, but it was a very large field to begin with. And even in the largest field, even in the earliest days of the electoral campaigns of various candidates, it seemed as though there was so little difference when it came to gay rights, women's rights, reproductive rights, etc., that the GOP candidates seemed so unified in their overwhelming rejection of what most mainstream Americans take for granted.
Absolutely. The price of admission to this year's GOP presidential race was that every candidate had to swear orthodoxy on these social issues, on abortion, on gay marriage, on don't ask, don't tell. Even more extreme issues like rejecting civil unions for gays as well. And this is the result. It's the natural and logical result of what's been going on for 40 years, what I call the sexual counter-revolution.
So even as progress is made, I mean, when we think of don't ask, don't tell, we must remind ourselves that it was log cabin Republicans who pushed this issue in court, gay Republicans who have fought alongside, you know, gay liberals and Democrats for the inclusion of gays in the military. Even as mainstream America is, you know, watching shows like Glee in huge numbers and enjoying them, we're seeing these people who are front and center of American politics, being candidates openly and proudly proclaiming their opposition to these to women's rights, to gay rights, to reproductive rights. How have they been able to get away with it? Let's go back historically. Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about conservative women in the 1970s.
Yes, this is the surprising thing, that all of this really stems from a movement that started in the 70s. In reaction to the sexual revolution and feminism and gay rights, basically a group of people freaked out about sex. And they wanted to take the country back to a time when birth control was illegal, when gay sex was illegal in every state, even when there was no-fault divorce. And the very surprising thing about it, for me, having done the research, is that it all started with women. Hmm. It started with religious conservative women.
And what was also surprising to me going before that is the history of the GOP's relationship to feminism and reproductive rights is also little known. You discuss in your book that Barry Goldwater was a feminist.
Barry Goldwater supported abortion rights, supported the Equal Rights Amendment, and then later, when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell issue first came up in Clinton's administration, said gays, Americans have a constitutional right to be gay. Oh. Just amazing. So, yes, the Republican Party actually used to be much better on women's rights and personal liberty issues. Now, if we take them at their word that they're the small government personal liberty party, that makes sense. And until this sexual counter-revolution that gained steam in the 1970s and early 80s, that was true. The Republican Party was more firmly committed to equal rights and personal liberty.
Now, you say in your book quite clearly that it's not that sexual counter-revolution is the defining issue that Republicans have to kowtow to, and certainly issues of race and class and so many other issues play into it. But it's not a very well-known history, and that's why you write the book. So what did these conservative women in the 1970s do to turn the Republican Party into one where where reproductive rights are now seemingly the most important litmus test?
Absolutely. First, they got active against the Equal Rights Amendment, and they killed it. Their next campaign was, this will be surprising to people, was against federally funded child care. Federally funded child care passed by a bipartisan majority in the 70s, and conservative religious Southern women organized against it to kill it, taking it off the agenda, really still till today. And then they mobilized in the first referendum campaign to take gay rights away. And after that, they infiltrated the Republican Party at the lowest levels, at the precinct levels. They started running for school board. And they started taking the Republican Party over from the bottom to the top. Basically, they're very good political organizers, and their political organizing has always been focused on electoral politics. So they've made it impossible for politicians who disagree with them to survive in the Republican Party. So what they did is they drove millions of people out of the Republican Party. And actually, the Democratic victories over the last 20, 30 years have been because of the Democratic Party's progressive positions on women and gays and racial issues and multicultural issues. And the Democratic Party needs to recognize that its progressivism is actually what's winning at elections, instead of running scared when the Republicans pull out all these cultural wedge issues.
Right. And I want to talk about the Democratic Party, but so isn't it true then that the very effective grassroots organizing that was this backlash to feminism, to gay rights, has created a very, very active block, minority block of voters in the United States who hold so much power with their votes now that they have changed the fabric of an entire major party and also caused the opposition party to be scared? I mean, it's that well-organized sort of machine, if you will. And if so, what are their demographics?
Absolutely. So their demographics are, so in terms of the country, these voters, people I call sexual fundamentalists, represent about 17-18% of the total national electorate. No more than that. They're overwhelmingly white. They are getting older and older. And they are religious traditionalists. They are evangelicals. They're Mormons. Mormons identify with the Republican Party at about 95%.
Wow.
They're the most party-oriented voters, more than African Americans, more than Jews in the Democratic Party. It's quite amazing. And then you have the Orthodox white Catholics. Not all white Catholics. So that's who makes it up. Starting to be a much older population and a much smaller population. I do think we're seeing this portion of the electorate shrinking, basically as people age and also as people become less attached to organized religion and more multicultural, more racially diverse.
Is this group of 17 to 18% of Americans also, where do they fall within the class structure, if you will? Because that pertains to the question of why are these issues more important to them than issues of, say, corporate dominance of the United States, of the economy? They seem to vote based on issues of reproductive rights, even if it may not affect their lives personally, but it moves them so deeply.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, here's where I think our conventional wisdom is most wrong. These are not working class voters.
Okay.
They're not economically stressed voters. They are often better off than their peers, or solidly middle class, or lower middle class kind of managers, small business owners. They're not union members. They're not industrial working class. So this whole idea that there's been a bait and switch with stressed working class voters over stressed over economic issues and diluted into voting on these social issues, it's just not true. These people are well off, relatively speaking, and their economic ideology is much more attuned to the Republican Party's idea of small government and let business have free reign.
So there is an intersection there, so that we shouldn't be surprised when this group places a greater emphasis on reproductive rights than on economic injustice. So what about the Tea Party, which came in on a populist platform?
The Tea Party is nothing more than a rebranding of the Christian right. And the statistics on the Tea Party, 50% identify with the Christian right. 2/3 want Don't Ask, Don't Tell restored, even though 80% of the country as a whole supported the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Older, whiter, wealthier. The populism was a front. It was a way to change the subject because they know, having been thrown out of power with Bush, that when they're front and center with these crazy sexual politics, with their religious zealotry, the American people recoil. Pretty universally, Americans do not like religion being injected in politics. And when they see it there, they move to reject the politicians that have brought the religious zealots in with them.
I'm speaking with Nancy Cohen about her new book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. So let's talk about the Democratic Party. This is supposed to be the party of progressive politics, and we think of it as a party that has defended Roe versus Wade since it happened now 39 years ago last week. We think of it as a party that on at least issues of reproductive rights and abortion knows where it stands, but that's not the case.
Yes and no. So to be sure, the Democratic Party is far more progressive than the Republican Party, and it does support reproductive rights. However, the problem with the Democrats is when they're in power, they're divided and they can't get things done. And then when they get thrown out of power, often for not getting enough done, they overreact. And the key thing is when they overreact, they blame their base. Hmm. They blame women. They blame gays. They blame feminists for alienating so-called mainstream America. And the problem is this is just flat out wrong. Democrats actually win elections for standing firm on these reproductive issues. It was a huge factor, for example, in Clinton's election in 92. A quarter of voters had abortion as their number one issue.
Wow.
And we remember Clinton running It's the Economy, Stupid? He ran very forthrightly as a cultural progressive. He stood up. He was the first president to stand up for gay rights.
Right. His issues
election.
On the economy were another thing altogether.
Right. I mean, it was the economy. He was much more centrist on the economy, but he was very progressive for his time on the cultural issues. And it paid off. That was the election when Bush ran on the holy war.
Right. What about President Obama? As I mentioned, he has not always been forthright. He has, and you quote this in your book, he has said his views are evolving. Is this, and of course, Obama is the great compromiser. Are his views on reproductive rights and other cultural issues part of that?
This is where I think Obama is somewhat wishy-washy. In the 08 campaign, he knew that he should be the progressive to reach the base and inspire people. But I think he's been infected with this kind of democratic disease that if we talk about these issues too publicly, we're going to alienate people. So we see him one week issuing this bogus ruling, not allowing Plan B to be sold over the counter. But then just last week, I believe, standing firm that birth control should be covered by health insurance companies.
In the face of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Yes. So it would be nice to have this idea out in the public domain that Democrats really can win elections if they just stand on principle on these things. And I think so many years of running scared and panicking every time Republicans take control has left its mark on Obama, too.
Right. And it seems as though there is a great panic in both parties to want to woo that 17% to 18% of Americans that have these politics. Perhaps because that group of people vote so diligently and literally religiously, and perhaps because the rest of Americans only vote in large enough numbers when they are really motivated to do so, as in the case of Obama's first election.
Yes, both parts of those, that is really important. So first off, the Democrats tried wooing the 17% after the post-Bush panic in 2006. And they brought in a lot of anti-abortion Democrats. What they discovered is, though, that those 17% never vote for Democrats, no matter how much appeal Democrats make to the really orthodox, traditionalist religious voters, they don't get their vote. So that's the situation in the Democratic Party. In the Republican Party, it's a little different. The Republican Party is left with no choice because this is the largest block of Republican voters. And because they're so organized within the party, they can't put together enough voters outside of that base to do it. So they're being held hostage by the sexual fundamentalists.
And so how has this also created a fissure within the Republican Party? What has it done to the party? I mean, notwithstanding the fact that leaders within the party have flip-flopped on their views to come into line with the sexual fundamentalists when they have decided to run for office. But just within the party's political machinery and with, you know, with the lower level staff and other officials, is this a cause of great debate within the party or polarization within the party?
The fight that you see over whether Romney is an acceptable candidate or not is in some ways a proxy for this. However, what you notice is Romney's made the same promises as all the rest of them. He will outlaw gay marriage. He will try to overturn Roe v. Wade.
And don't ask, don't tell.
And don't ask, don't tell. He's told Huckabee that he supports constitutional amendments defining life beginning at conception, which would have the effect of outlawing birth control, as we know, outlawing in vitro fertilization. So the Republican Party, though, is in a bind because back around the time of Reagan, the one percenters, we can call them, signed on with the sexual fundamentalists because they know they're not voters who want to overturn the minimum wage, who want to end Social Security. So these are the only voters they have to enact this economic agenda.
Well, finally, Nancy Cohen, it seems as though the advice you would give to progressives is fairly obvious, but also to the Democratic Party in terms of who they should woo. But put it into words anyway. What needs to happen for the majority of Americans who have views that are very progressive on cultural issues, on sexual women's rights and gay rights to push sexual fundamentalism to the margins where it arguably belongs?
This is going to sound overly simple, but I really believe it's the case. It's just a matter of staying tuned in to what's going on and voting in every election. 40 million people who voted in 2008 did not vote in 2010, and that's how the Tea Party rolled into power.
That's when the Democrats lost the Congress. And
exactly.
The Republicans won.
So when people stay tuned into electoral politics and stay active, we can put an end to this delirium.
Simple as that, huh? And
let's hope.
And advice to, if you had President Obama's ear in this election year, what would you say?
I would say, look at the numbers, President Obama. You will win by standing up for gay rights, for women's rights, for personal freedom, and tolerance.
Well, Nancy Cohen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Is there a website you'd like to recommend or any speaking events that you have?
You can follow me on Twitter at Nancy L. Cohen, and my website is the same name. And you can find the book at any online retailer or in your local bookstores.
Great. Well, we will feature your book on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. I want to thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Nancy Cohen is author of the book Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. And for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Susan B. Anthony once said, it was we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people who formed the union. Men, their rights and nothing more. Women, their rights and nothing less. That's Susan B. Anthony. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Kevin Walker is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.